Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. At a congressional hearing yesterday, Inspector General J. Russell George, author of the audit report on the targeting of Tea Party and Patriot groups that applied for the tax-exempt status at the Cincinnati office of the IRS, told lawmakers that he had found no evidence of political motives, which inspired this question from Senator Michael Crapo of Idaho.
Now, have you reached the conclusion that there was none or that you haven't found it?
It's the latter, that we have not found any, sir.
Because it seems to me that it's almost unbelievable to look at what's happening and then say, well, there's no political motivation here.
So, two questions. Was the sorting process used in the Cincinnati office illegal or unethical? And, of course, one more question, I guess. Who knew what when? Joining us now to get started is Michael Beckel, a politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity since February 2012. As a money and politics reporter for the Center for Responsive Politics, he covered the landmark campaign finance case Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here.
I thought we could start today with a look at what apparently has led to this extra scrutiny of the Tea Party groups and others in the Cincinnati office of the IRS. At the hearing of the Senate Finance Committee, Democrats said a deeper problem is the muddle of laws and regulations that govern political activity by 501c4s, and that muddle is the result of Citizens United. What's the connection?
The Supreme Court's Citizens United decision in 2010 was a game changer in the campaign finance landscape. One of the things that it did was create incentives for new organizations to be able to come into the political game and expressly advocate for or against federal candidates. These 501c4 organizations have been around for decades. They are allowed to be involved with politics, but they are not allowed to have the primary purpose of being involved with politics. And one of the things that the Citizens United ruling did was make it that these C4 groups could spend money, including money they received from corporations, unions, or wealthy individuals, and use those funds to produce ads that call for the election or defeat of federal candidates. Previously, if they wanted to air such ads, they could only collect limited amounts of money. There is this type of legal category called a qualified nonprofit, which expressly said that we don't get money from corporations or we don't get money from unions. So if you wanted to be politically active and talk to your members, that was okay. But prior to Citizens United, you couldn't use these big dollars from corporations or unions to do that. And after Citizens United, it was a free-for-all.
So there was a proliferation then of 501c4s, or
at
least
exactly
requests
right.
for that exemption.
Yeah, we have seen on the campaign finance side of information a increase in the amount of politically active nonprofit organizations. These could be unions or these could be 501c4 organizations, which are social welfare as their primary purpose. These could be 501c6 organizations, which are business leagues or trade associations, such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And the IRS has said that it has seen a surge in applications for these 501c4 social welfare groups as well. In its 2012 fiscal year, we know, based on some of the data books that it publishes, that there was almost a 50% increase between fiscal year 2011 and 2012 alone.
So while these types of nonprofits can't be in the business of influencing elections, they are allowed to call for the defeat of candidates. What's the difference? How do they make that distinction at the IRS?
It all comes down to what its primary purpose is. Nonprofits are a great vehicle to get involved with issue advocacy, and over the years, they've been able to expand that role. There was a big Supreme Court case back in 2008 called Wisconsin Right to Life versus Federal Election Commission that talked about whether some 501c organizations could air issue ads ahead of the election. And then in Citizens United, we talk about expressly advocating for or against candidates. There's a rule that is often bantered around. The IRS has never been quite exactly precise on what this primary purpose test is. Some people say it it's up to 49.9% of its time or effort or finances, and other people say that percentage should be lower. But there are organizations out there that have been very active in the political arena, very active calling for the election or defeat of candidates, or very active airing ads that either tout a candidate or criticize a candidate around a particular issue during the election season. And that is a new legal freedom that a lot of these groups are enjoying.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Michael Beckel. He's a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. We're talking about the IRS scandal. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So a primary purpose could be some kind of social welfare activity, but a non-primary purpose could be the expenditure of $500,000 on a calling campaign to tell voters not to vote for somebody.
That's right. When you look at the 501c organizations that exist, most of the quintessential 501c4s are groups like the Rotary Club or the Kiwanis. You also have seen issue advocacy groups that might be a nonprofit, such as Focus on the Family or Planned Parenthood, National Right to Life. These groups will have a charity arm, but they also have a C4 arm. So when you write a check to the Sierra Club or National Right to Life, if you write that check to the 501c3 arm, that's tax deductible. But if you write that check to the 501c4 arm as a donor, that's not tax deductible, and that money can be spent on lobbying or these other political purposes.
How many of these kinds of groups are out there, and how does the IRS have the ability to audit them to make sure they're following the rules?
There are thousands of these organizations, and when the IRS is going through the applications, we've seen usually in most recent years about 1,500, maybe 1,700 applications for the 501c4 organizations per year. In fiscal year 2012, that number rose to about 2,700, almost 2,800, according to the most recent IRS data book. And the IRS folks who are going through these applications are concerned about a couple of things. One is, how politically active are these groups going to be? Is their primary purpose really the engagement of social welfare, or should they be registered under a different section of the IRS code? There is a separate code, Section 527, that all political committees are registered under. And so if you are a political action committee or a party committee or a candidate committee, you get your tax-exempt status under Section 527, and that means that you have to disclose all of your donors who give you at least $200. So the big difference between the Section 501c4 organizations and the Section 527 political committees is whether or not donors have to be disclosed. And if you give money for general purposes to a 501c4, that's not something that has to be publicly disclosed. But if you give money to a political committee and you give at least $200 or more, that is money that does get disclosed.
Do we have a sense about how often 501c4 applications for tax-exempt status are denied?
That's a great question, Anne. And one of the things that we are looking into at the Center for Public Integrity is just that, based on some of the preliminary research that we've done, the IRS seems to very rarely outright deny a 501c4 application. In the last 4 years, they've processed thousands of applications and only officially denied 20 of these applications. There's a whole big other pot of other applications. Sometimes groups might voluntarily withdraw their application, or sometimes the IRS goes back and forth asking for more information. So of these thousands of applications, we know that they approve typically 80-85% of the applications in the last 4 years, and the number that they've officially rejected is a very, very small sliver of that big pool.
Last week, you wrote about the incidence of Tea Party groups and other conservative nonprofits getting involved in electoral politics, and you said it was rare that they did that. What are they doing then if they're not getting involved in politics?
Well, as the Inspector General report noted, when the IRS workers were coming up with their criteria, their be on the lookout list, they used words such as Tea Party, Patriots, 912 as a shortcut for trying to figure out which groups might be too politically involved. And when you go back and cross-reference the Federal Election Commission filings, mm-hmm. any group that has called for the election or defeat of a federal candidate, or any group that has aired what's known as an electioneering communication, one of these issue ads that mentions a candidate ahead of the election but doesn't overtly call for their election or defeat, there are very few of these groups using these buzzwords that reported any spending to the FEC. So they can be actively engaging citizens in their community. They can be engaged in a wide variety of activities, both issue advocacy or political activity, but what they have been doing hasn't been rising to the level of requiring reports to the Federal Election Commission.
There were complaints last year. U.S. Senator Rob Portman of Ohio has said that he sent a letter to the IRS with concerns about the holdup in the application process for the 501c4 in the cases of a lot of these Tea Party groups. What do we know about that and whether or not somebody dropped the ball at that point, including the media, I suppose?
One of the points in the Inspector General's report is that the average time that these groups that were put onto this special scrutiny, these groups have an extended amount of time that they've just been waiting to figure out whether or not they're tax exempt. In many cases, it was over a year, sometimes over 2 years, sometimes over 3 years of just waiting and waiting and waiting, trying to figure out if they were going to be given the tax exempt status that they applied for. And in the case of a 501c3 charity, that means that the donors that would want to give to that organization don't know if their contributions are really going to be tax deductible. There could be foundations that don't know if they really want to give money to this type of operation. And we know that there were cases of organizations, rather than continuing to wait and wait and wait, simply decided to call it quits. And that's a real disincentive. And one of the things that Steve Miller did during these congressional hearings was apologize for this horrible customer service that these groups were waiting and waiting and waiting with no clear idea of whether or not that they were going to be approved or denied. They could not get a straight answer from the IRS.
The U.S. Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, was made in 2010, right?
That's correct.
2010. Did the IRS immediately start considering the impact on its not only its bureaucracy, but how they were going to respond and what sort of process they were going to put in place to, winnow through these what was roundly expected to be an increase in applications?
Right. We saw the Citizens United Supreme Court case come down. Mm-hmm. We saw the rise of the Tea Party activist movement, which was in and of itself spurring a lot of folks to get more actively involved in the political process. And very early on, you saw folks in the campaign finance reform community raise questions about some of these big spending 501c organizations, these big 501c4 organizations that were coming in saying their primary purpose wasn't politics, but then making millions of dollars in expenditures. And some of these groups have continued to operate. Crossroads GPS, the 501c4, conservative 501c4 that was co-founded by Republican strategist Karl Rove, recently said that it believes it's under investigation by the IRS. That organization has never officially been told whether or not It is a 501c4. It has just continued to operate under the assumption or hope that it will be getting that tax status.
Okay, I'm talking with Michael Beckel. He is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Coming up, we're going to have a fellow at the Urban Institute and also an editor of TaxVox, the Tax Policy Center blog, join us as well in this conversation about the IRS scandal. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Gordon Lightfoot, appearing live at the Palace Theater July 29th at 8 p.m. Reserve tickets for Gordon Lightfoot go on sale this Friday, May 24th at 10 a.m. through the Kappa box office and all Ticketmaster locations.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Apple in the hot seat. Lawmakers say the company dodged billions in taxes on overseas profits. We'll look at the world of offshore tax escapes. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for May is the Gateway Film Center. Enjoy two-for-one admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides. We're talking about the IRS scandal. What's going on? The hearings are ongoing at this point in Washington. Still with us is Michael Beckel. He is a politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Michael, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Also with us is Howard Gleckman. He's a resident fellow at the Urban Institute and editor of TaxVox, the Tax Policy Center blog. He is a former senior correspondent in the Washington Bureau of Business Week. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Hi, Ann.
You've written that this is a matter of bungling but little scandal based on the report by the Treasury Department's Inspector General for Tax Administration. But the search for an agenda is not over. I mean, bungling or whatever, they're looking for a reason for this.
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting. I mean, the congressional hearings seem to have morphed. I mean, very quickly, they've gone from an attempt to find out what happened, you know, back in 2010, 2011, and now it's really all about the cover-up. It's you know, what did the White House know and when did it know it? And most of the focus of this hearing is not what's happened over the last 3 years. It's what's happened in the last couple of months, which is kind of interesting. It suggests to me that there is not a lot more to learn about the actual events at the IRS.
And yet that's what I'm very curious about.
Me too.
Michael Beckel and I were talking before you joined us about how long, what was expected after Citizens United. We didn't necessarily know what the form, the vehicle was going to be, but we knew that there was going to be an increase in groups asking for this kind of exemption one way or another or using it. But what did the IRS do to prepare for this?
Yeah, first of all, I don't think we knew, at least I didn't know, I mean, maybe Michael did, but I sure didn't know that 501c4s were
right.
going to be the vehicle that these groups were going to use. You know, 501c4s were never intended for this. They were supposed to be for, you know, community organizations, civic associations, that sort of thing. And some clever lawyers figured out that these were a perfect mechanism to launder campaign funds, because there is this requirement, as you all were discussing before, that there's no disclosure of the contributors in 501c4s, unlike most other nonprofit organizations. So it was a perfect vehicle. But I sure didn't expect they were going to use it. I didn't know it then. Maybe other people did. The IRS clearly didn't. The other thing to keep in mind is the IRS is completely overwhelmed. The IRS can barely keep up with its principal job, which is collecting taxes. As the tax code gets more and more complicated, the IRS gets more and more behind the curve. But worse than that, it, in the last several years, has been given the responsibility to manage all kinds of other government programs that it was never set out to do. Most recently, on the Affordable Care Act, it is now a big player in health insurance, something about which it knows practically nothing. So it basically, in the last couple of years, has been putting the full court press on trying to get caught up with the Affordable Care Act to the detriment of much of the other things that it's supposed to do, including, as we've discovered, approving applications for nonprofit organizations.
A New York Times article described the Cincinnati office as an outpost that was alienated from the broad IRS culture and given little direction. Michael and Howard, do you agree with that? That's part of the problem. And I'm wondering, no one's mentioned, are there other outposts out there?
The IRS has these outposts across the country that are tasked with doing different parts of the application or enforcement process. And so one of the things that we've seen historically was that there was a move to move some of these offices away from Washington, D.C., and away from the political hubbub that can infect all lines of work and business in Washington, D.C. So the thinking was some of these places away from the Beltway might be more immune to some of the political winds.
I guess, ironically, in a way. Howard Gluckman?
Yeah, the IRS has gone through these sort of centralization and decentralization fads, and it seems to, you know, it seems like almost every commissioner goes one way or the other. And this was caught up as part of this decentralization fad, as Michael said. They were trying to, ironically, get this out of Washington so it would be depoliticized. It's important to keep in mind that the tax-exempt part of the IRS is a pretty obscure little corner of the agency. And the 501c4 section is an even more obscure corner of the agency. This was not ever expected to be controversial or complicated. These were pretty routine kinds of applications. And suddenly this thing blew up and the service was completely unprepared for what happened.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Howard Gluckman, resident fellow at the Urban Institute, and also Michael Beckel, reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. If you have a question or comment, we welcome them, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Brian in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome, Brian.
Oh, thank you very much. And okay, so I'm not a supporter of the Tea Party, but I think that if this had happened to any organizations, left or right, that it would generate a lot more concern. I mean, the IRS should theoretically be neutral and not suppressing one particular view. And the fact that the guests don't like the Citizens United decision. I mean, it is a law that, you know, changing the law would be appropriate, not necessarily targeting people with one viewpoint. And those organizations, you know, their education could be just basically publishing people's voting records. So, for example, if a Republican had a very poor record on pollution or voted for, you know, big tax cuts or whatever, those organizations would theoretically be allowed to publish that and to have be put out phone calls and so forth and do whatever they want to buy commercials. And they seem to be fairly effective. I used to be involved with a 501c organization back in the 90s that was basically a think tank, and we tried to our mission was to try to find things that left and right could agree on and try to find middle ground. I think that characterizing these things as some, you know, malevolent organizations that are run by these lawyers and to try to pretend like this particular effort of trying to suppress the Republicans is kind of disingenuous. And I think that the press should be a little more concerned about it rather than trying to make excuses.
Is that the case, Michael Beckel? I mean, is that how you read what this Cincinnati IRS employees in Cincinnati were doing, was targeting them on the basis of doctrine versus, I thought it was just keywords.
One of the things that the Inspector General report noted was that the BOLO list that was developed, the Be on the Lookout list, as it was called, used buzzwords such as Tea Party, Patriots, 9/12, and also took into account some of the ideological viewpoint and policy positions that these groups held as they were trying to figure out and suss out if these groups were going to be too political or deserved special scrutiny. In the end, there were only about a third of the cases used those buzzwords, but groups on the right, on the left, have both been complaining about this. It looks like the conservative groups were much more targeted than the liberal groups, although a few liberal groups have said that their applications were rejected. And at the end of the day, neither Republicans nor Democrats want the IRS to be a political arm of any administration. And that's why we've seen a lot of bipartisan outrage on the Hill during these ongoing hearings.
Howard Gluckman, you're concerned about the cost to groups that were seeking the tax-exempt status. A few were denied the status in the end. So what are the costs ultimately?
Well, you know, first of all, let's go back one step. I want to respond to what the caller said, if I can. Mm-hmm. You know, this does, in fact, put the IRS in an incredibly uncomfortable position. The law says that in order to be a 501c4, your primary purpose has to be social welfare. So there's three big questions here that has to answer. First thing is, what does primary purpose mean? That's not really clear. Some people said, well, if you spend 50% of your money plus a dollar, that's primary purpose. Well, the statute isn't really that clear in either of the regulations. The second issue is, what is social welfare? And nobody really knows what that means. And then the third issue, which is the one that, of course, has bubbled up in the last few years, is while these groups are allowed to do some kind of politics, as long as it's not their primary purpose, what does that mean? And what has happened is, even though the statute was around for 100 years, the 501c4 provision has been around for 100 years, until the last couple of years, it was really never used for this purpose. Now what's happened is the IRS is in a position where it has to regulate political speech. It has to decide whether or not an organization is a political organization or not. And that's what's making everybody very uncomfortable. The IRS tried to do this in a particularly clumsy way, and of course, we now have the scandal that we're all facing. Mm-hmm. But the real question is, how could they do it? I haven't found anybody who can really give me a satisfactory answer to what would you do? How would you have the IRS regulate this in a way that 501c4 status isn't being abused, but on the other hand makes it possible for people who are legitimate organizations to get approval in a reasonable amount of time?
Do we have any sense about why the IRS didn't come out up front and center saying, we've got a problem here, people. We have thousands of these applications coming in, and the government, Congress has not, you know, no one, the Supreme Court gave us directions and definitions to do our job.
You know,
stupid? Or
it would be really nice if Washington worked like that, but it doesn't.
I know.
I mean, this is part of the problem, of course. The members of Congress who are expressing, you know, high dudgeon outrage about what the IRS have done have had the opportunity to change the law for years and never took it.
Brian in Worthington, thanks a lot for that call. Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome, Don.
Yes, you mentioned that IRS in Cincinnati could be somehow separate from the rest of the IRS system. I was wondering if that was in a political way or a bureaucratic way or something, and especially if it's in a political way, that concerns me a lot, because we all know that Hamilton County and the surrounding area is the bastion of liberalism, and anything goes here in Cincinnati, except that's not right either. Hamilton County is one of the most conservative counties around. How a conservative county could attack or be somehow implicated as enemies of the Tea Party is far beyond me, unless it's a double cross where they set them up.
Okay, well, this, I mean, obviously the IRS is not a county agency, but what do we mean by the alien? Is this just a bureaucratic thing or a political thing? Howard?
Well, I don't think it was political. I think what happened is there was this sense of this effort to decentralize this office. And again, remember, when this was done, nobody anticipated that this office was going to be overwhelmed with all these political applications. This was simply a way to move, you know, frankly, what was seen as a fairly unimportant part of the IRS outside of Washington, and move it to another office. I don't really know what was going on in the Cincinnati mm-hmm. office, what the relationship was between Cincinnati and Washington. But let's not leave people with the impression that this happened, you know, in a conscious effort to take these very hot button political issues and move them to Cincinnati. This was a decision that was made entirely separate from what was going on with what bubbled up as this controversy over over 501c4s.
Okay, Dan.
And
thanks
one of the things,
Michael.
And one of the things that Stephen Miller mentioned during his testimony was that he thought that this was a branch that had insufficient personnel to handle these things. Over the years, the IRS, like many other federal agencies, has seen cuts and cuts of employment. And there's a question about whether the IRS has the resources it needs to deal with this this particular problem.
Lois Lerner, the head of the tax-exempt organization's division of the IRS, has refused to testify. She's, I guess, what we'd call it, taking the fifth to avoid self-incrimination, which brings up the issue of crime. Is this simply an impropriety that the IRS has engaged in, targeting specific groups this way? Or is there a question about whether it's legal and whether there's criminal activity going on?
I think most of the controversy here, most of the legal jeopardy, again, is not about the activity that occurred in Cincinnati in 2010, 2011, but it's about the cover-up.
Okay.
the potential crime here is lying to Congress. Now, it's sort of a punchline of a joke: would any jury convict anybody for lying to Congress? But that's a separate issue. So once again, we've kind of stepped away from the fundamental issues, the issues that I guess we're all very interested in, which is what was going on with these approvals or non-approvals of these requests for tax exempt status. And now it's really about did somebody mislead Congress or not?
Michael, thoughts?
Yeah, I think Howard's answer hit the nail on the head. The outrage that we've seen in Congress has focused a lot on who knew what when, and the steps that were taken, and the fact that Lois Lerner doesn't want to say anything that would incriminate herself or perjure herself. You know, that was sound legal advice that a lot of the election law community would say that that's exactly what she needed to do, was to plead the fifth, even though she's got more answers to this than a lot of other people might.
Well, back to the policy stuff. Why, maybe I've asked this already, but I just want to be clear. Why does the IRS do the screening in the first place? Why don't they just wait, issue these tax exempt status, and then wait for 501c4s to break the rules and get them that way?
That's really not the – I don't think it's the way the IRS wants to do things.
Okay.
I think what they want to do is determine at the beginning – whether or not it's legitimate for you to do it. Now with 501c4s, it's less of a problem than it is with 501c3s and some of the others. And sorry for all the numbers, but you know, there are 20-something different kinds of tax-exempt organizations, which is also part of the problem. So think about this. There are two big differences in tax-exempt organizations. One are those organizations that are not only tax-exempt themselves, but may also accept tax-deductible contributions. And there, the liability is not with the organization, it's with the contributor to the organization. So if you give money to an organization in good faith because you think it's a 501c3, and it turns out it shouldn't have had that status, then you now have a problem. So the IRS wants to make sure that that's all cleared up, you know, at the beginning. Now, these 501c4s are different because you're not allowed to deduct your contributions to the groups, although there's actually some question about whether corporations can take a business deduction for contributions to these groups. But ordinary for individuals, you don't, so it's a little bit easier. But still, the culture at the IRS is you don't want to grant somebody tax-exempt status and then go back again. And then one other point about it, the law is still so vague that even if you had somebody who was granted status and they then engaged in whatever activities they were engaged in, there's still no telling whether or not that's appropriate or not.
Howard Gluckman. Go ahead, Michael.
There's been two main questions that we've seen wrestled with during this application process. One is how political these groups are, and the other one is the question of private benefit if one of these organizations is set up in a fashion that's benefiting one individual or one group of people more. That can also be grounds for the IRS to reject or deny the application. So if it's got a relationship with a contractor, or if the folks who are running it are going to financially gain from that organization, that's also been a question that the IRS asks of these groups frequently.
Howard Gleckman, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Howard Gleckman, resident fellow at the Urban Institute and editor of TaxVox, the Tax Policy Center blog. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about the IRS scandal when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
If you've bought a gun lately, you might feel safer, but you could be making other gun owners nervous.
I think what worries a lot of us is that with all of the talk about guns and self-defense, that we now have novices walking into gun stores and buying a gun who really know nothing about it.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Make sure that safety's on, people. The story next time on Marketplace from APN.
This afternoon at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
The IRS Tea Party targeting scandal. We'll get the latest from the Washington hearings and some analysis. And then it's Wellness Wednesday, the genetics of Angelina Jolie's decision and more. That's today on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 a.m. to noon on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
89.7 NPR News is your source for local news, public affairs reporting, and NPR News. Listen for news on 89.7 FM and at WOSU.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about the IRS scandal. Still with us is Michael Beckel. He's politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. Joining us now is David Keating. He's president of the Center for Competitive Politics. It's an organization dedicated to protecting First Amendment political rights of speech, assembly, and petition. He also has served with the National Taxpayers Union and Americans for Fair Taxation. Welcome to the show, David Keating.
Thank you. Good to be here.
The Center for Competitive Politics submitted some questions last week in advance of the congressional hearings on this issue. Let's go over the questions. Number one was, how and why did the IRS come to inappropriately review certain tax-exempt organizations? Are you still convinced that the reviews, now that we've heard some of the explanations, were inappropriate? Do you think they were illegal? What do you kind of answers have you received, and what do you think of them so far?
Well, the investigation is still very early on, and there are no conclusive answers. We still don't know how or why this came about, and that's something that we really need to get to the bottom of. I think a big part of it is that there's been a lot of external pressure on the IRS from people on Capitol Hill, rhetoric from the White House, from groups such as Democracy 21, the Campaign Legal Center, and others, demanding that something be done about 501c4 organizations. And I think the bureaucracy has, responded, and responded in an inappropriate way. In fact, there is a law on the books that makes it illegal for the White House staff to urge directly that the IRS employees audit a group or do other things.
Well, what indications are that the IRS was doing this because it felt pressure?
We don't have any indication yet, but let me, since I did work and I was on the National Commission on Restructuring the IRS, I worked for a taxpayers group for many years. In the 1980s, it was well known that the IRS used inappropriate quotas to collect tax dollars. And what was happening was the IRS was going out and merrily collecting money that in many cases wasn't owed because people were willing to pay it just to get the IRS off their back. And that generated a huge controversy that the IRS was using quotas instead of applying the law properly. So when the IRS, and that quota, I think, came about because they were getting pressure from Capitol Hill and elsewhere that there was a tax collection gap and the IRS needed to do something
and there,
about
and
it.
There was proof of pressure at
yes,
that point?
Absolutely. Okay. There were quotas. There were actual written quotas to come out with this.
But you're suggesting so here, that there was pressure here, brought to bear.
Yes, there's no doubt there was pressure brought to bear. The Capitol Hill, several Democratic senators sent letters over to the IRS demanding that things be done to crack down on 501c4 organizations. For one example, many of the so-called campaign finance reform groups have been putting pressure on the IRS and using the media to do the same. So when this sort of thing happens, I don't think we should be too surprised if that was a factor. Now, we don't know that yet, but look, anyone who gets criticism from the outside and gets a lot of it, subconsciously or subconsciously, there's going to be a response.
Well, I mean, nobody gets more criticism from the outside than the IRS. That's pretty much across the board. Michael Beckel, have you seen any indication that there was outside pressure either from, you know, quote-unquote good government groups or the Obama administration itself or Congress, too?
The campaign finance reform community groups like Democracy 21, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, Campaign Legal Center, have issued repeated calls for the IRS to investigate certain big spending groups that they are claiming are masquerading as 501c4 organizations when they should be registered as political committees. One of the apparent ironies of this situation is that it has been a lot of the smaller Tea Party groups, these more grassroots conservative groups that have been caught up in the IRS mess so far, and some of these big spending groups, it's not clear what level of scrutiny they've been getting from the IRS.
How is the IRS, David Keating, how do you imagine the IRS should manage this influx of applications for 501c4 tax-exempt status that they've received in recent years since the Citizens United case went through?
Well, first of all, the increase is vastly overblown and something that's completely within the IRS's ability to handle. So I actually think that's a non-issue. And in fact, the IRS is generating way more work than necessary, asking the kinds of intrusive and unnecessary questions to drag out the process. So if they'd handled this stuff quickly and correctly from the get-go, there would have been a lot more less work for everyone involved. So I think that's part of the problem there. Another huge part of the problem is the IRS guidance on what is a political activity and what is not is it's ridiculously vague. And one of the problems with it is that no two persons who try to even objectively apply this criteria could possibly come out with the same answer unless you have a clear case all the way to one side or all the way to the other. But there's a huge amount of gray area in between, and with the criteria being what they are, it's impossible for the IRS to audit fairly organizations. So what we've seen and what I've heard from people who work in this field as nonprofit counsel is that if you're working with a liberal group and your liberal group runs across sort of a born-again tax examiner, you're going to have a hard time. And likewise, if you're a more conservative group, you run across more liberal tax examiner, you're also going to have a hard time. And the reason why is there's enough wiggle room in these criteria that even if someone tried to objectively apply them, their personal biases are going to come out.
Michael Beckel,
that's something that's got to be fixed.
Michael Beckel, do you agree that there's that much wiggle room, so much so that an individual IRS employee could make those kind of decisions?
David is absolutely right that these regulations are extraordinarily vague, and one of the conclusions of the Inspector General report was that the IRS should have better guidance issued on this point.
So everybody agrees on that, but where that guidance will come from, Congress, is that the idea? David Keating?
Congress certainly could clarify it, but it's also within the power of the IRS and the Treasury Department, which does the regulations, to come up with guidance that could be fairly clear and relatively simple. That's something that really does need to be done to take some of the subjectivity. In fact, it should be possible to take almost all of the subjectivity out of the process. Now, if they do try to do this, there's going to be probably pushback from these so-called campaign finance reform groups that frankly want disclosure of everything for any type of activity, even lobbying activity. And a lot of people who believe in free speech and what the First Amendment says just think it's totally inappropriate to force disclosure of every single thing that people give to organizations.
Frank? Hello, Frank and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome, Frank.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of concerns about this issue, and I appreciate what your guests have been saying. My first concern would be that it seems like that I keep hearing the word conservative, that the IRS has targeted conservative groups, and in the names Patriot and Tea Party, I think you've got a lot of more of the fringe elements of the Conservative Party. I don't think it's not like they were attacking the Republican Party in general. They were, you're looking at groups that by their very nature and by their definition are anti-tax, some to the extreme that they don't think taxes should be legal at all. And I think it's well within the IRS's responsibility to look at these groups with a little extra scrutiny. I think that's more than reasonable. I mean, they're charged with collecting taxes, and we've got some of these fringe elements that are apparently applying for tax-exempt status who come right out and say they don't believe in paying tax. So,
I guess the question is it fair to generalize those kinds of groups, even if that is the case, with some key words? David Keating?
Well, first of all, these groups are hardly fringe groups. Most of the Tea Party groups are not saying you don't need to pay your taxes. I mean, that's completely ridiculous. So, yes, I think there's a problem when the IRS is using indicators of ideology, whether it's anti-war groups, pro-peace groups, pro-choice groups, groups that think government has gotten too big or is not following the Constitution. People have First Amendment rights. They should be able to organize. They should all be able to get an equal chance at tax-exempt status, and they should not be singled out for special scrutiny simply because of their ideology. And everyone agrees that's what's happened here, and that's why there's been such a strong reaction.
Michael Beckel, this isn't the first time the IRS has had problems with these kinds of issues.
Right. Over the years, the IRS has become embroiled in many issues and many political controversies. And one of the points that I wanted to make to the caller was that the name alone might not tell a lot of information about a group, and that the names alone were being used for shortcuts has been one of the troubling elements of this. While you look out at the universe of 501c social welfare organizations, these 501c4 organizations, not a lot of them have overtly political names, but as part of the application process, the IRS also asks, do you plan on engaging in lobbying activities? Do you plan on intervening in electoral politics? That there is more context than the name alone that the IRS can be using to answer these questions.
David Keating?
Well, I do think part of the problem is the guidance has to be clear, And the IRS should definitely not be going off ideologies, whether it's a liberal, progressive, conservative, or anything else. They need to apply the law fairly and impartially. And I actually think there's a good case for taking this sort of thing out of the IRS altogether. The IRS doesn't have expertise in the First Amendment. They don't have expertise in anything but really tax collection. And so I think perhaps part of the solution would be to take a lot of either one, vastly simplify the process, or two, take this out of the IRS and put it into something like the Federal Election Commission that has more expertise on political activity and First Amendment rights.
Do either of you think anything good could come out of this at this point? That something might change because of it?
Yeah, I do. I think this has been a problem for a long time. The vagueness, the uncertainty, it's been kind of like what we've had here. I kind of make the analogy to some people. We have like a plane crash what the IRS has done in terms of the spectacular nature of what's happened. But in reality, for many, many years, the IRS has been employing these vague criteria to make it very difficult for groups, whether they're conservative or liberal, if you happen to get the wrong examiner. And so my hope is now that there's recognition that the criteria are vague, that needs to be fixed. Maybe it will be fixed. So that's my hope, is that it will be fixed. I also think the IRS has gotten such a shock that this will, if this activity stays in the IRS, this will be embedded in the agency's culture of, we better not do this again. So I think the fact that they did it and got such a strong reaction may help avoid a repeat.
Michael Beckel, we're just about out of time. Any parting thoughts?
Well, clearly this scandal has spurred a big conversation about the IRS, the Federal Election Commission, and these groups that have become increasingly politically active. And I think that discussion is ongoing, and it remains to be seen what exactly will come out of it. But there's been a lot of ideas offered by folks, and that discussion is very vibrant and is definitely continuing.
Michael, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Michael Beckel is a reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. And also David Keating, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
David Keating, president of the Center for Competitive Politics. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.